Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, another Rebooting the News with Jay and myself. Jay, how's it going?
Hi Dave, welcome to our listeners as well. It's going well.
Good.
This is Rebooting the News number 19.
Good. I leave New York in your hands now.
Yeah, you were in New York last week, which leads to the first thing that I want to ask you about, because you took one of your road shows, as you call them, to New York this week and held a rooftop meeting with people who are interested in RSS in the cloud, or what Anil Dash called the push-button web, and a bunch of developers and geeks, I gather, were there to help you think through some development. So I wanted to ask you some things about that, even though I read about it, and I read Anil Dash's post, and I also listened to your other podcast, Bad Hair Day. So I want to ask you a few things about that as a way of getting into some other themes that we will develop in Rebooting the News 19. Is that all right?
Sure, of course.
Well, first of all, who was there up on the rooftop, and why were they there, and why would they come to something you call a roadshow about the RSS cloud? I mean, what draws them in?
Wow, that's a good question. I don't even really know. I mean, I know I have an idea of who was there. I mean, they were almost all developers, and they were all readers of Scripting News, scripting.com, because that was the only way that I publicized it. And I like doing these things outside of California because we escape the church of the savvy that we have here in California, which complicates things enormously. In New York, which is, you know, America's largest city, you know, capital of finance and all sorts of other things, it actually is sort of a backwater in the technology business, which makes it a good place to sort of take something like this, an idea like this, on the road, you know, sort of the way they open a Broadway play in Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston, San Francisco, et cetera.
Okay.
You can try the idea out, see how it plays, and then, you know, build up a little bit of confidence for, you know, the real rollout, which is going to take place probably somewhere here in the Bay Area where I am now.
And what is this idea that you're taking on the road this way?
Right. Well, it's... the idea, I call it the 140-character, loosely coupled messaging network. Long name. Maybe it'll get shortened, hopefully.
140-character, loosely coupled messaging network.
Right. And
got
140
it.
Character, of course, is the, you know, is a hat tip to Twitter.
Right.
You know, the loosely coupled part is the anti-hat tip to Twitter, because Twitter is not in any way loosely coupled. It's highly centralized.
Mm-hmm.
And in any loosely coupled network, you need to have a little bit of centralization. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is to hack at it until there's the minimal amount of centralization. So, you know,
okay, so let me go over it again. The 140-character loosely coupled network, you said?
I would throw the word message in there, too.
Message the network,
gotcha.
Because the idea
is we're going to push messages around, yeah.
Right. Okay.
And so the messages have have a bunch of properties to them. And it turns out that the properties of a message are very similar to the attributes of an RSS item. And I don't think there's a coincidence to this. We as human beings conceive of things in certain ways, and all these things were conceived by human beings, so they all sort of work the same way. And so where human beings have added the ability to push pictures through Twitter by throwing a URL at the end of the tweet, RSS has the ability to do an enclosure, which has a little bit more data and is a little bit neater in the sense that the URL of the picture doesn't at all take up any space in 140 characters. So it's in addition. It's sort of an extra.
Gotcha.
And, same thing's true with movies or audio clips. Like this podcast, for example, could be attached to a tweet.
Right.
And, you know, you could still write your 140 characters. You wouldn't have to worry about this. And by the way, there goes the URL shortening problem. You no longer need to worry about that because send the long URL. It doesn't matter. It doesn't take up any space.
A vastly improved system. So go on.
Yeah, we're trying to improve things. That's the whole idea. I mean, in many ways, Twitter has a lot of good things going for it, but in many other ways, it's a step backwards.
Okay, so it's Twitter minus all of the annoying limitations, and where each Twitter message is really kind of like a boat that can carry other things important to
it. But minus the biggest irritation of them all, which you set me up for this, is the corporation that's in the middle of it.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, this sort of leads to a continuing theme in rebooting the news, is that it's to the chagrin of the big corporations that the whole point of the internet is to obviate the need for them and to make people more independent of those big corporations.
And okay, so I think I understand what you're saying, that what we really need has been revealed by Twitter, and what we really need is a 140-character messaging system that's loosely coupled and doesn't require any big company at the center of it, even though there's still a need for somebody to be a domain name authority.
Yeah, well, that's right. The loosely coupled part is where we have a disagreement with the company, and in a loosely coupled world, there's no one to create a suggested user list. There's no one to not share stock with Hollywood superstars. One of the ideas that came out at the roadshow that surprised me, that I hadn't really been focusing on at all, was the potential opportunity to serve those Hollywood stars. Ashton Kutcher, who is, I guess, the highest number of followers on Twitter, over 3 million now, said in a speech last week that he wants his independence of Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty tall order, and it's not possible right now to do that, for him to be independent of Twitter.
Oh, okay. So I got it. So these are different directions, is what you're saying.
Yeah, we're going back to the internet, basically, or trying to go back to the internet. There's no, absolutely no guarantee it works, and also no guarantee that this is the time for it either. You know, I've felt this way about Twitter since virtually the beginning, but we all decided to overlook the problem of it not being loosely coupled and just go ahead and use it and then see where it led. And
all right, cool.
Yeah.
So it was a good meeting, and the real tests are still to come, but there is sentiment out there that such a thing is possible, and that's kind of interesting.
I think so, yeah.
Okay. You know why this interests me, Dave? The more I've studied Twitter and also listened to you make this point that you just summarized about it not being loosely coupled, not open, the more I've understood the reason why we're so obsessed with Twitter and why so many journalists have also been drawn to it and why it's still sort of in the center of one part of the conversation of the new news system has to do with this notion of updates. If we click on that and we just go sort of down into it, into the depth of that notion of updates especially to subscribers, the people who asked for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
The people who need to be kept updated. In that idea is not just a news business. The very idea of news is related to a world that needs to be updated. Like before news, before political history started, before the public had any role in it, before we were able to try and affect our fate, you didn't have constant updates to the world because it was settled the way the world was.
I'm sorry, what does that mean? It was what?
Well, in a highly religious society, in a controlled society, the world that isn't different every day. It's more like a sameness comes over it. But in our world, the notion of updates and that things have changed and you need to know that and there are decisions to make and so you have to be kept updated, all of those ideas are central to what news is, to how we conceive of it in the first place. And so Twitter, but more realistically, this this network that you described, the loosely coupled 140 character messaging system that everybody can be access and is open, is like modeling an idea that is very close to and almost coincident with the heart of news itself, mm-hmm. which is, here's the way the world has changed. Here's your update. For those who care, this is the new situation. This is what just happened. I'm here, and here's your update. And so people who need to be kept informed because they run empires, status updates. People who need to be kept informed because their loved ones are at risk, status updates. And so that's why we keep putting Twitter in the center of things, is this notion of updates to the people who need to be kept updated about mm-hmm. a shifting world
yeah.
is the modern notion of news.
It's pure news, absolutely. And why it wasn't instantly recognized by lovers of news as being that. And well, in a way
it is. They are drawn to it for that reason.
Absolutely.
Partly that reason.
And I would maintain it's the best of them that's drawn to it. It's
mm-hmm.
it's their moment of suspension of disbelief. They stop worrying so much about how they pay for things because at their hearts they are news people, right? And if this is pure news, how you pay for it will come up eventually, but it's secondary to, wow, this is news, pure news, right?
And this system now exists, and we have to figure out what news to run over it, you know, to run on it.
And then what limits are we prepared to accept? The 140 characters with the URLs baked in there and the hashtags, I didn't even mention the hashtags, right? That all these things that are the RT symbol that, you know, takes three characters. You know, all these things were sort of decisions made by consensus because there was absolutely no choice. There was no other way to do it.
They're crude, ad hoc measures that are not organic to the system and
one would
are
hope it's
all arbitrary, basically.
Yeah, they're absolutely arbitrary. And one would hope that at some point, you know, one of the other things that's inexorable only for the last 200 years or so is progress, the idea that we'll always keep reinventing, you know. You know, one of these days, progress is going to have to hit Twitter, and I don't know. Let's hope that it's not like explosive. That's what I want, is to be continuous. I'll get to the more. This is amazing how it connects up with what I want to do for the inspiration. So
should the Washington Post pay its sources is a question that we want to take up. And there's a background to it, which I will give. Yesterday, an interesting article was posted at the Washington Post site called The Death of Journalism, Gawker Edition, by a younger journalist named Ian Shapiro, who actually covers the 20-something generation for the Post. It was all about his 1,500-word article on a professional who teaches others how to market to that generation. And Gawker, the online-born news site that Nick Denton created, did a post about this article. And at first, he says he was thrilled that he got picked up by Gawker, but then an editor of his said, "Man, they stole your story. Where's your outrage?" And the more he thought about it, the more outraged he got. And he ended up writing this rather lengthy piece, headlined The Death of Journalism, Gawker Edition, in which he says, for example, "After all the reporting, it took me a day to write the 1,500-word piece. How long did it take Gawker to rewrite and publish it, cherry-pick the funniest quotes, sell ads against it, and ultimately reap 9,500 and counting page views?" And so it became this story of, you're stealing our journalism and failing to credit us properly, Gawker, and that sort of thing is destroying journalism, which then created a significant debate in our community about whether he was right about that and whether that even made sense. And in the midst of all that, people started to say, well, wait a second, if the Washington Post is saying that Gawker is stealing its news, then what about the sources who give news to the Washington Post, whose ideas and quotes get used for nothing. And if we're going to start charging people for using and talking about the news we're reporting, where does that transaction begin? So it's in that context that you raise the question, should the Washington Post pay its sources? What is your answer to that?
No, of course not. And, I mean, unequivocally, no. And I thought that question was raised by the Wall Street Journal. Didn't they have an editorial that said that they should pay the sources?
That was a parody piece by Kevin Marks.
Oh, that was a parody. Oh, I didn't get that. Sometimes these parody things fall flat, and you just sort of, they fool you. I'm very gullible, but... of course they shouldn't pay the sources, but it raises an interesting question, and you have to try to find the dividing line, and where is the origin of the value of the news story, and maybe the news people need to stop and think a little bit before they get all, sort of... I don't know what the right word is. I don't want to characterize it in a negative way, but they get defensive about this supposed property of theirs, which is really something that it's very hard to find why it is, the reason why it is their property. Mm-hmm. Jacob Harris at the New York Times asked me to ask you a question, and I guess it's because I don't do interviews, so that's why the question has to be asked of you. Is why do you subject yourself to interviews?
Right.
You being a source, I think that the assumption behind the question is there must be some value in it for you or else you wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I do quite a bit, and it's certainly part of my job as a journalism professor to talk to journalists about issues in journalism when they're doing stories. And I do it because I want to be helpful to them. I do it in part to get my ideas out there, but I've also noticed that increasingly it doesn't really make sense for me to do it when I am interviewed on subjects that I have my own ideas about and have written about a lot myself, because actually the chances of the garbled version detracting from what I'm trying to say are often greater than whatever broadcast value there is in what I end up saying in a quoted account. So what I said was that I usually do serve as a source if I trust the reporter, if I feel lucky, and if I don't have any reason to mistrust the person. But lots of times, just talking to a journalist for 35, 45 minutes and having 9 words selected almost arbitrarily from that conversation, there's no percentage in it for me. And because the chances of a distorted version of my thought emerging from that are very high. And so in that sense, I often decline to be a source when I feel that bargain is a bad one.
Yeah,
because I have another way to get my ideas out there.
Right, that's exactly how I look at it.
It changes the situation.
Right, and in early in our both of our careers, I mean we're roughly the same age, you and I. You didn't question whether you talked to a reporter. It was an honor to talk to a reporter. It was a sign of validation that may have
it
been,
is. That's normally the way I feel about it.
That may
not
be
always
a product of being younger, and but I also think it's a product of the times as well, because in every way I have a much better mechanism for me to express my ideas, even though it means sometimes less volume. And when I went from writing for Wired to writing a blog, I took a huge hit in volume that day I quit the job. But I had the advantage of having the words that I wrote actually represent what I believe.
Right.
And for me, that was a far more important thing than the volume. The volume was flattering, but it wasn't what I was about. I was about trying to learn, and in order to learn, I had to put be accurate in representing my ideas. Otherwise, the feedback I would get would be, you know, hey, you idiot, and I'd have to go, yeah, you're right.
Here's an example. Here's an example from last week or so. I spoke to a New York Observer reporter in a very good interview, very good exchange, about the editing of the NewYorkTimes.com homepage, and she was doing a feature on it and talked to a bunch of different people about it. And in the course of talking about the difference between a front page in a printed newspaper and a front page on the live web, she mentioned that they said they don't look at any of the usage numbers when they edit the page, or people told her that at the New York Times. And I said, wow. And I had two reactions to that fact. The first was that how can you actually edit your page if you don't know what the users are clicking on and what you don't know about usage patterns? It didn't make any sense to me. How could you be good at editing NewYorkTimes.com if you didn't? If you took like a veil and placed it over the usage data, I couldn't possibly see how that made any sense. And then I also said, on the other hand, to be completely traffic-driven, to be driven by clicks, would be an idiotic way to approach the New York Times.
Wait, let me guess. It was the latter that got quoted.
No, it was actually the first one. I couldn't believe that they didn't look at the data. Yeah, but it doesn't matter because only one reaction was represented in this piece. That does not help me. That hurts me.
Right.
It actually hurts my brand, as it were, and to use a crude term, but it defeats my purpose in trying to understand online journalism. And I told the reporter this, and she said, well, you know, it's editing, and I understand how it happened, and it's not her error at all. It's journalism. It's the relationship between sources and reporters, because what she did in quoting me was completely within the rules as they stand.
Totally.
She did not make any mistake. She did not violate any
canon.
That's
the problem, right?
You know, and we that's the problem, yeah.
We ought to
explain that to her.
We ought to put a bookmark on this one, okay, right here, and come back to this, because when we solve the problem, when you and I re-architect the news, when we really finally get down to the nitty-gritty of this is, you know, the J. Dave prescription for how to reboot the news, we must deal with this issue. In other words, how will the rebooted new journalism system work when a source feels like it's worthwhile to be interviewed by a journalist?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to think about there.
We just have to get away from
like fighting over individual quotes, and you know, but there's a lot to think about. Let's put a marker there,
I want to say one other thing is that I often talk off the record with journalists. In other words, not for
so do I. Yeah,
no quote because of the first part of your reason. In other words, I generally want to be helpful, right? And but in consideration of not wanting to be misrepresented or hurt my brand or any of that stuff, I will more likely write a blog post and say, please feel free to quote anything from there that you want. Mm-hmm. That way, at least the universe has my official, this is how I really feel about it, on the record. And that way, there's no question about what I actually thought at that point in time. So
right.
I find that works for me. And so they don't need to pay me to do this. I there are a lot of things I do that I don't get paid for, but I'll tell you one thing. This goes back to the original question, but one of the things I would like is a little bit of appreciation and acknowledgement that, you know, the sources actually are making an important contribution because they leave the sources out all the time in their description of who are the heroes of news. And the sources, without the sources, they wouldn't have any news. So I think they need to take another look.
Wouldn't it be interesting if you could look at a long, complex work of journalism and see along the right side the list of all the sources?
Yeah.
Along with sort of some sort of percentage of how much they were relied on in the story?
We've been talking about that for a long time, Jay. You know, Doc Searles has been writing about that. And we want, that's the transparency Weinberger was talking about. In other words, it's part of the transparency.
Yeah.
You know, let's see your notes. You know, let's see how you got there. You know,
right.
Because we have minds too. You know, it came up in that whole Columbia Journalism Review piece where the guy was trying to explain, although not explaining, why the AP was so angry about, you know, appropriation of their content. Now we finally have a clue as to why they are so angry, actually. And I put in there, I said, you know, please just give us the information so we can make up our own minds. That's another key thing, is that the readers are sentient human beings. They're Homo sapiens.
Right.
They have brains. They think. You know, give them the raw material so they can make up their own mind.
Well, it's more than that. It's more than that, because this is a way of building trust. If I say to you, oh, you don't believe me? Here are the documents. Go look.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? If I say to you, you don't believe me? Here are the people I talked to. Go look at what they said.
Right.
You don't believe me? Actually, it's based on this decision, you know? And
yeah.
The more that you can say that, it's not only a response to criticism,
Because
if people take you up, they now trust you not just about that story,
right.
but about your next story.
Absolutely.
And so that's why transparency is the new objectivity, but also that's why here's where we're coming from, here's who we talked to, and here's why we said that.
Yeah.
You know? Then you have a chance to actually construct trust article by article, piece by piece, right? Transaction by transaction.
Right. This goes back to the example of the 50 most powerful blogs in the world The Guardian had, you know, and no indication of how that was put together.
All right. Now, this relates to something else I wanted to talk to on this podcast, which is because we are realizing, as Dave Weinberger put it, that lots of things we thought were properties of the news were really just properties of paper, which is a good
thing.
Did he really say that? Yes, he did.
That's beautiful.
His post, Transparency is the New Objectivity. He didn't put it exactly like that, but I'm
very good. That's pretty much.
Yeah.
By the way, paper's not very transparent.
Right. So I'm realizing the same thing, that lots of things we thought were properties of news were really just properties of paper or the tools we had at the time, right? It's becoming clearer and clearer to me that in the rebooted system, where we can overcome some of these limitations, the updates, the news stories, the recent accounts, have to be accompanied by more than they were in the era of print. So when a reporter who's been covering a ongoing story that comes in and out of the headlines posts their update on the Enron trial, if you don't have the background to know where the Enron trial is right now, that update has very little value for you.
Mm-hmm.
And in the era of print, where the article, the 1,500-word article, was the unit of excellence, there was a very limited range of options for how you displayed the back narrative that makes the update important, right? Mm-hmm. Usually you try and summarize it in a paragraph that pointed actually back to earlier journalism, but there was no way to actually get people there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually incredibly inadequate. But now we can serve the update and the narrative. We can give you the information and the backstory.
Yep.
We can give you, and lots of times you may enter through the backstory and realize that there are updates or vice versa, right? And so one of the properties of the rebooted news system is that it'll have the story, what happened recently, and you'll always be able to go back and say, how did we get here?
Yes. There are so many things to say about that. It's one is that the Twitter as it is currently implemented, Twitter system cannot do that.
Exactly.
And so it's an obvious, enhancement. And you know, it's one of those. One of the ways I try to figure out what's going to relax about what's coming in the future is to say, can you imagine a world where you can't do that? And you know, if you can't, then you know it's coming. It's never mind what how powerful the existing players appear to be today. If
that's right.
If they're standing against that, they don't stand a chance.
That's the way I feel about here's where we're coming from.
Pardon me?
That's the way I feel about here's where I'm coming from. That way of generating trust, of disclosing with everything you report, here's where we're coming from.
Right, right. Absolutely.
That
that's
coming.
The of
whether
the
you agree or not, it's on its way. And if you're in the path of that, you're going to get run over.
Well, and then there's, right, exactly. You don't want to, goes back to if you find yourself in competition with the internet, find a way to get out of it because it's not going to work. The other thing, this is an article that didn't make it onto our list, and it probably should have, maybe for next week. There was an article, I think it was in the Times, where they said, New York Times, where they said that the internet spelled the end of serendipity. That,
yes.
I don't know, did you see that piece?
I did.
You did or you didn't?
I did.
You did. And I always am very suspicious of things like that, but I read it and tried to consider their point of view. And I don't agree, of course, because it just created new avenues of serendipity, and you just described one of them, right? In other words, you're sitting there reading the slice in time. This is what happened in the Enron case today, okay? However, there's this whole context that is attached to it, and if I'm really interested in this and I want to understand it, I'm going into that context.
Yes.
There's your serendipity. I never would have in the old world. This is, if you turn back your clock and go back in time, you'll miss that. You won't have it.
That's right.
And
it's not only that, Dave. It's if you want to make money on the updates, you better put a lot of excellence into the background. Maybe it's great background that leads to a thriving business in updates.
Yes. And this is why I've always been puzzled why the newspapers are so scared or seem to be so scared of the future, because it is so about their skills. You know, we have all, not all, but so many of us have turned into rabid consumers of news that why it should be no trouble to find a product in here that we're like, wow, I got to see more of this. And
exactly.
That's always in tech. That's what drives the value of your stock. If the users feel like, wow, I have to see what comes next, you can be sure they're going to see what comes next. They'll pay to do that. And one way or another, you're going to get the money to get to that next stage, because the users drive everything.
Excellent.
I think now I would like to start on the trail of the inspiration of the week.
All righty.
Okay.
We have about, 7 and
we have a lot of time for it.
Okay.
And it should be a discussion. So, okay, I'm going to start at the end and say that the inspiration of the week is Doug Engelbart. And I chose Doug because last week you chose Marshall McLuhan. And I think that Doug Engelbart plays a very similar role in technology that Marshall McLuhan plays in media. Mm-hmm. He sort of is at the root of every tree. You can't go back through modern technology, the mouse, Windows, graphic computing, outlining, which is near and dear to my heart, all these things. The first guy to do them was Doug Engelbart. But that's not why I chose him, not because of all of his invention, which is prodigious. I mean, the man has made a huge contribution to the art of computing. It's because of this concept that he identified, which is at the core of everything that we do, and it's called bootstrapping. In fact, it's the name of our podcast. Our podcast is called Rebooting, which means bootstrapping again. Now let me lead up to this. I had a really interesting hour meeting with Jeff Jarvis. It's always nice to see Jeff in New York this week. And, we talked about lots of things. But towards the end, he asked me sort of an open-ended question. What advice would I give his son, Jake Jarvis, who is a 17-year-old programmer, successful entrepreneur, I might add. He's sold a product for a significant amount of money. And he's starting at Carnegie Mellon. I think he's at Carnegie Mellon right now, actually.
He's at a summer program for high school students at Carnegie Mellon.
Right, there you go. So he's about to go into his senior year. But he's got a promising career already started. And so I said, okay, here's what I would do. Here's my advice. Number one, be a user yourself. That means if you're going to be implementing software, do it. Do something that you yourself are a user of. If you're not, you're never going to understand the feedback that you get from users.
Mm-hmm.
And then number two is listen to your users, because that's your grounding. You know, the myth of Silicon Valley is that all ideas come from the intellect of the genius, and I find that's not true. I find that the really best ideas come from synthesizing what you hear from the users of your products, or users of other people's products, for that matter. And this was all part of the concept of bootstrapping. And at the time I gave the advice, I didn't realize it. And it was more thinking about it, realized that the idea of the bootstrap is that you make the tool that you need to make the tool. So, you know, I remember once telling my uncle that, you know, it would be as if you had to make a hammer in order to make a hammer. And a lot of things in computers are like that. You need the tool before you can make the tool. And
I get that, yeah.
Pardon me? Yeah, I mean, I'd love to find other things. I mean, maybe news about news. Maybe you can't have a news system until you can have a way of distributing news.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of belies reality. How could it be that way? But it is that way. You know, you get to this point in a computer science curriculum where you take a class in compiler design, and compiler is a way of converting a program from human-readable symbols into machine-readable symbols, and it's a necessary element. You can't get anywhere without a compiler, or unless you like typing in ones and zeros, which they did at one point have to do. Somebody had to type in ones and zeros to get to the point where we're at. But then you take your compiler and run it through itself, and it's a mind blower. How did that work?
Right.
But
so that you need the tool to invent the tool. I get that. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
So that's bootstrapping. So what does that have to do with Jake and Doug?
Well, to be a user, you have to be a user. In other words, to invent something for users, you yourself have to have the tool. Maybe I'm not explaining this well, but
I think you are. You're saying that by being a frustrated user, you will see what tools are needed.
That's right. And in order to be that frustrated user, you must first be a user.
Be in the game.
Right. And so this says to the news business, I guess, if we're trying to take the lesson of technology and apply it to media, then it says that in order to be a producer of news, you must first be a user of news.
Okay. I'm on track with you.
That's it. That's the story.
Okay. Here's what that inspires in me. When people ask me what advice I have for a young journalist going into the field, they often say, you know, should I start a blog? Should I be on Twitter? Or, you know, should I try for a job in print or something like that? I don't answer any of those questions because I don't have answers to those questions. But I tell them that if I were a young person starting in journalism right now, the first thing I would do is find a group of atomized people who need to share information to become a community and be useful to that group of people as a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
Find a community to be useful for as a journalist and practice in that sense for a group of people. And if you do that, you will learn the things you need to learn. You will invent the things you need to invent. You'll f- find the tools that are right for you, which is a way better method than starting by joining Facebook, you know, or having a blog, or catching up with the latest fad or wave in technology. None of that brings you to the heart of journalism. It starts with being useful to people who need to keep up with their world, who need updates, who need the narrative and the information about recent events. And I really think that's the soundest approach.
Mm-hmm. And Engelbart would certainly agree with that.
So Engelbart was at the root of the graphic interface revolution that came out of Park and Alan Kay and that whole thing?
He predated it. He was doing that at SRI in Menlo Park before any of those guys were doing it. You know, you should see what his early mouse looked like. It was a, you know, square wooden box, but it was a mouse in every sense of the word. You know, as a young computer scientist, I thought I had discovered something when I did an outliner. I wrote a, you know, tool for editing computer programs that understood structure. That was the and you know, up till that point, in my opinion, in my experience, never seen anything like it. I mean, all the tools that edited programs were edited them as if they were letters, you know, paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. But programs are not like that. Programs are hierarchies, and being able to manipulate them as such, I thought, and it's turned out to be so. I mean, the tool that I use is to write my software is very much an outliner. And I thought, well, this is, you know, a breakthrough. And it wasn't, because Engelbart had already done it 10 years earlier. And, as a young computer scientist, that was a little bit disappointing, right? Because you always hope that you've, you know, found the, you know, the you know, theory of the universe.
What's the best way to study Engelbart and what he did?
Well, ironically, there isn't really a great way to do it. The way most computer guys did it was by reading the book written by my first choice for inspiration, which was Ted Nelson. Ted Nelson wrote a book called Computer Lib and Dream Machines. And in that book, he chronicled Engelbart's work, and that's where I discovered it. It was after I had written my outliner and had the whole system working. Then somebody said, after listening to my spiel at Madison, that you really do need to go look at Nelson's book. And so I did, and there it was. It was all there. But it's not a really good treatment of it. And frankly, there probably isn't a good one out there yet. He's alive, though. Engelbart is I think, in his probably late 70s or early 80s, and lives in the Bay Area. He's around.
He must be very satisfied with what has...
He's not, actually, very satisfied. No.
That's what I... Huh.
As we are very well aware, right? generally, you don't reach... I mean, it would be nice if a guy like that, you know, did, but he doesn't seem to be satisfied. He's driven, which I think is a good thing, right?
Well,
I mean,
that's good, too, yeah.
Yeah. And he doesn't feel that his ideas have fully disseminated, and that is absolutely true.
Well, Richard Stallman's the same way. He's not satisfied at all.
No.
He's very angry a lot of time.
But Stallman actually probably should be inspiration at some point. He's a wonderful guy.
He certainly should be.
Yeah. I mean, I find him very inspiring, especially because the world is so negative on Stallman. You know, when you actually meet the guy, you find that he's very sensitive, very sweet, very considerate person, and a deep intellect, very, very strong ideas. You know, and
we could both claim him as inspiration of the week.
Really?
I'm very influenced by him, absolutely.
Really?
Which reminds me of something else I want to talk to you about in another podcast, the Halloween Memos incident, if you remember it. I want to ask you about that.
Eric Raymond?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's another. I could talk about Eric Raymond. Eric's a good guy, too, and I didn't always think so, either. So there you
Both of them had a major influence on me.
Cool. Well, I'll put that one down. And I think we're just about out of time now, Jay. Thanks again for another great Rebooting the News.
Dave, it's a pleasure to exchange ideas with you.
Right on. Okay. Bye.